Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Ukraine Today, a view from Australia. I'll introduce our speakers briefly. We're going to lead off with Andrew L. Urban, who's a journalist and author of Zelensky, the unlikely Ukrainian hero who defied Putin and united the world, along with Pete Schmeagle, who's a good friend of the Institute. I should say Andrew was here last time talking about the book he wrote with Margaret Kinnean. And also tonight, Pete Schmeagle, who makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's a writer, he's a former political advisor with a background in Ukrainian affairs. Now, Andrew, of course, is also the author of Zelensky, the unlikely Ukrainian hero. Now, we're going to lead off with Andrew, talk for about half an hour. We go to Peter, he'll talk for about half an hour, then we'll do questions and discussion. And so, Andrew, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Nice to see you all. Somebody's wearing half the flag colours, yellow. Thanks for inviting me. I want to, as co-author with Chris McLeod, who's in Melbourne and can't be here, I'd like to talk about the making of the book. They usually talk about the making of films, but I'd like to talk about the making of the book because it's a little bit different. It was late on morning on Saturday, March 4, and the invasion of Ukraine by the Russian Federation had begun some 10 days before. My publisher from Melbourne, Michael Wilkerson, rang to ask if I'd be interested in writing a book about the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. I said, what, the most famous man of the moment? The hottest topic in the news? Inspirational leader dubbed Churchill in a T-shirt, that's Zelensky? Yes, yes. Wilkinson's American partners, Regnery Publishing, wanted to have the very first book about Zelensky on the bookshelves. And they're based in America, but they publish around Europe as well. So we had an international meeting on Zoom, of course, with the Regnery executives, and off we went. Sure enough, it was published just over 2 months after that invasion began. It was quick. I work quick. And that's not a boast, but my natural modus operandi as a journalist. And this book is a work of journalism. We hung up and I opened a new document in my computer titled Zelensky. Now, I was asked to deliver the manuscript on Zelensky, but there were no guidelines. It was up to me what I made of it. And then Chris McLeod was brought on board by Michael, and we worked together very smoothly and organically. Chris is an absolute bloodhound on research. The title, Zelensky, the Unlikely Hero, was so obvious and natural that I and the US publishers came up with that independently and pretty well simultaneously. I was first. We followed the invasion and Zelensky's urgent calls for weapons and support in real time. I mean, it was possible with television, social media, internet, and the press. We were almost like embedded with the Ukrainians. We watched the video broadcasts to the European, the British, the Australian parliaments, and to the US Congress. No other world leader had previously addressed so many parliaments in so few days in such compelling manner on such an urgent topic. Thank you, Winston. In today's fully interconnected world, I was able to sit at my Sydney desk and monitor the world events that were of interest to me for this project. Perhaps in the Q&A session to follow, we can explore if and how this facility impacts on both events and the perception of them. Excuse me. Being a Hungarian with an ingrained sense of what I call survivor humor, very similar to the Jewish genre, one of the first searches I did was to see what black jokes had been prompted by the invasion. And sure enough, there was already a string of them. There was one that, in a nutshell, captured the mood in Ukraine. President Putin and his driver were on their way to Kyiv in a car when all of a sudden they hit a pig near a farmhouse, killing it instantly. Putin told his driver to go up to the farmhouse and explain to the owners what had happened. About an hour later, Putin sees his driver staggering back to the car with a bottle of Horilka, Ukrainian vodka, on one hand, a cigar in the other, and his clothes all ripped and torn. "What happened to you?" asked Putin. "Well, the farmer gave me the Horilka, his wife gave me a box of cigars, and their 19 and 21-year-old daughters made mad, passionate love to me simultaneously." "My God, what did you tell them?" says Putin. The driver replied, "I'm President Putin's driver and I just killed a pig." When the Russian tanks rolled into Hungary in 1956 to crush the revolution, the puppet communist government had taken back control of the radio. As the tanks shelled our freedom fighters, the radio broadcast reassuring messages came through the air that the Russians, Soviets in those days, were here as our friends, come to root out the unpatriotic troublemakers and foreign agitators who'd caused all the trouble. Well, it was soon countered with survival humor. "Thank God they're our friends. Imagine what they'd be like if they were our enemies." So some people rankle at this sort of black survival humor, but I agree with Stephen Fry's observation that the very reason or raison d'etre of humor, its saving grace perhaps, is that you can laugh at something and at the same time take it seriously. The only editorializing in which we indulge in this book is on the subject of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum. Zelensky was 16 at the time. The memorandum can be summarized as follows. The United States of America, the Russian Federation, and the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland welcome the accession of Ukraine to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons as a non-nuclear weapon state. Taking into account the commitment of Ukraine to eliminate all nuclear weapons from its territory within a specified period of time, and noting the changes in the worldwide security situation, including the end of the Cold War, which have brought about conditions for deep reductions in nuclear forces, we confirm the following. We reaffirm our commitment to Ukraine in accordance with the principles of the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. We agree to respect the independence and sovereignty and the existing borders of Ukraine. We reaffirm our obligation to refrain from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of Ukraine, and that none of their weapons will ever be used against Ukraine, except in self-defense or otherwise in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations. We also agree to refrain from economic coercion designed to subordinate to their own interest the exercise by Ukraine of the rights inherent in its sovereignty, and thus to secure advantages of any kind. We reaffirm our commitment to seek immediate United Nations Security Council action to provide assistance to Ukraine as a non-nuclear weapons state party to the treaty. And if Ukraine should become a victim of an act of aggression or an object of a threat of aggression in which nuclear weapons are used. We reaffirm, in the case of Ukraine, their commitment not to use nuclear weapons against any non-nuclear weapon state party to the treaty, except in the case of an attack on themselves, their territories or dependent territories, their armed forces or their allies by such a state in association or alliance with a nuclear weapon state. And finally, we agree to consult in the event of a situation arising which raises a question concerning these commitments. Well, that didn't go down well, did it? Wasn't nobody abided by it? Professor David Flint wrote the other day in The Spectator in his overview of this book, from a Ukrainian point of view, the memorandum as drafted is next to worthless. How did Ukraine ever agree? Was it corruption, incompetence, or both? And why did the US and the UK allow a free new country to sign this? As the authors point out, by failing to invoke the memorandum, both the US and the UK not only violated the agreement, they have legitimized Russia's abandonment of it. And Professor Flint is right. In our research, we found only one instance in the earliest days of the invasion of Zelensky referring to the memorandum in his call for assistance. And it was not as forthright a demand to adhere to it as it might have been in our view. Perhaps he was all too aware of the weakness of the memorandum, which has no legal teeth. So there is that. Still, legal teeth in other international agreements didn't prevent Putin either. It is symbolic of the uselessness of the United Nations that the Russian Federation is still part of the UN Security Council, with veto rights still in place. If the United Nations was worth its salt, it would rescind or suspend at least the veto rights. China may then take note, but that's another story. By now, most people with any interest in Zelensky know that he grew up in Kryvyi Rih, an industrial grunt town south of Kyiv. As an only child, his father, Alexander, was a professor and the head of the Department of Cybernetics and Computing Hardware at Kryvyi Rih State University of Economics and Technology. His mother was an engineer. He's from a Jewish family, and his grandfather, Semyon Ivanovich, was the only one of four brothers to survive the Holocaust. The others were all killed by Nazis, but he's not a devout practicing Jew, and he doesn't talk about it. His wife, Elena, first found out about her husband's candidacy for the presidency on social media. She told Vogue, she said to him, "Why didn't you tell me?" His response was, "Oh, I forgot." He's still a comedian, after all. His party is named after his satirical TV show, Servant of the People, in which he became ultra-famous when his character, a teacher, delivered an angry rant about political corruption. Watching that episode during my research, it occurred to me that it could become a trendy new way of starting a campaign for political office. A fictional character delivers their election platform on TV, on a TV show, which captures the imagination of the public, and the actor becomes a candidate. We can no longer say that can't happen. His TV show was highly successful, even in Russia. At one stage, it was the third most watched series after Game of Thrones and Chernobyl. Of course, he has since been labeled Churchill in a T-shirt and the leader who wants the West's help with anti-tank ammo, not a ride to safety. I think my favorite quote from Zelensky is the one where he was questioned why he was running for president since he has had no political experience. They obviously didn't count the television show. And Zelensky replied, you don't need political experience. We just need to be a decent person. But I should also point out that our book is not intended to be a hagiography of President Zelensky. The book is intended to put Zelensky and his place in the current events and current events into context and to reflect on his managing the conflict as a politician, meeting the challenge of being thrust into crisis and potential greatness, at least in the eyes of some. After a triumphant election with over 70% of the vote in 2019, his popularity had fallen to just over 30% before the invasion. There's some really interesting things about his popularity and his standing, which I know Peter will refer to. And I'm really looking forward to hearing him. But finally, I'd like to put myself in context. I was born, how did I get here? Why am I doing it? I was born in Budapest well before the memorandum was signed. By the way, and escaped with my mother at the tail end of the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, when Russian tanks were sent to crush the freedom fighters. I am deeply sympathetic to Ukrainians. My father had fled to England years earlier after graduating from Budapest University, and he obtained his PhD in German poetry and language from London University. He worked at the BBC, and shortly after my arrival in London, he published a book called The 19 Days, described as a broadcaster's account of the Hungarian Revolution. And he became quite well known as a Cold War warrior and went on to become an acclaimed scholar of comparative communism and spent a stint as an advisor to Margaret Thatcher. My first novel, If You Promise Not to Tell, was set on the eve of Britain's handover of Hong Kong. A journalist all my working life, I focused on film for over 20 years and published an online movie magazine, Urban Cinephile. A decade ago, I was asked to review a documentary, Shadow of Doubt, about Sue Neill Fraser, a Hobart woman convicted of murdering her partner on their newly bought yacht. This case, which is now heading to the High Court, and finally just a just resolution, I hope, drew me into the world of wrongful convictions, and my first book on the subject was published a couple of years ago, Murder by the Prosecution. The publishers, Wilkinson Publishing, also published Zelensky, and my forthcoming book on Gladys Berejiklian, among others, in the pipeline. I'm really keen to hear what Peter has to say, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Peter Schmeigel.
Whilst I look to put my notes up, today's meeting is entitled Australian Perspectives on Ukraine, and Kryvyi Rih, the town where President Zelensky was born and raised, when translated into English, broadly translated into English, is Broken Hill. So there you go. Members Gerard and Andrew, ladies and gentlemen, thank you to the Sydney Institute for the invitation to speak about the situation in Ukraine, or more accurately, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and Putin's war on the West. Jared and I have known each other for 30 years, and Jared has been fostering discussion about Ukraine since before the Iron Curtain fell. And that is a consistency and commitment that's really appreciated by those of us who have long argued, well before today's events, about Ukraine's importance on the world arena, often to the very indifferent ears of policymakers. So thank you to Gerard and Anne and the team at the Sydney Institute. I acknowledge we're on Indigenous land, having recently returned from the better part of 3 months in Ukraine and Poland, where I worked as a writer and in humanitarian programs. I'm going to share some views with you based on four questions. Why is there a war being waged on Ukraine and Ukrainians? How is that war being waged? What's the current situation in that war? And what might the future hold? In addressing those questions, I'm going to challenge myths that come up when discussing Ukraine. And they are rife, and that's not surprising, given that Putin and the Russian Federation publicly hold that propaganda is in fact a weapon of war that's equivalent to bombs and bullets. Indeed, as the liberal democratic West, including Australia, responds to the very serious threat that this war is to our way of life, it's vital to call things by their real names. Clarity is crucial for ending this war and ensuring a more stable and prosperous global order. Or as one Ukrainian said to me, war leaves no space for bullshit. Along the way, I'm going to introduce you to some brave individuals who daily stand for the values that we in Australia might be accused of daily taking for granted. People that I worked with in Ukraine and had the opportunity to interview or to do work with. Let's start with Katerina Halushka. Katerina's 25. She's raised in a small agricultural village in eastern Ukraine. She's got university quals in liberal arts and communications. God bless her. Prior to the invasion, Katerina worked for a UN program in women's rights. Are you starting to get a picture? She's got long flaming red hair, and her tattoos are sort of the mark of, you know, that modern millennial generation and who they believe themselves to be and what they stand for. She could have easily left Ukraine anytime from February onwards and been very successful. Katerina instead chose to become a combat medic attached to the armed forces of Ukraine operating in the Donbas. Her daily task is evacuating injured soldiers from frontline positions to medical care points, and often under small arms fire and artillery fire. Near the start of the invasion, Katerina's soldier partner was killed in action, and her current boyfriend is a POW who is one of the holdouts at Azovstal in Mariupol. I didn't find any of that out about her until after I interviewed her. She never raised it. While she was on a break after three 24-hour straight long shifts at the front, I asked Katerina why she has chosen as she has. She told me that I cannot accept Russia's view that I, in identifying as Ukrainian and my nation, do not exist or do not deserve to exist. She rejects being called heroic and refers only to her duty. So herein lies a key understanding, I think, about why this war is taking place. Very simply, its root cause is Russian imperialism as fostered and fomented by the fantasies and fascist tendencies of Vladimir Putin. Part of Putin's arrogance and his cowardice is that he seldom admits his motives. Instead, he uses an old KGB trick, one that's actually in KGB textbooks called maskirovka. And maskirovka means intentional deception. It's actually part of Russian military doctrine as well. But those who know the history of the region know Russia has invaded Ukraine at least once per century since the 12th century. Those who know history know that the rulers of Moscow, which was founded long after Kiev, in fact, it was a mud puddle for most of the Kievan Rus' existence, have consistently denied the distinct culture that is Ukrainian and the territorial sovereignty of Ukraine. Those who know that the current aggression of Putin and his partners in crime is actually more of the imperial same. It follows that this war isn't about denazification. We heard from Andrew Urban that President Zelensky is Jewish. We should also take note of the fact that the immediate past prime minister of Ukraine, Mr. Groysman, is Jewish. And we should also note that the far-right vote in Ukraine has always been statistically about a third of that in France and in the UK. So, is this about denazifying? I think not. This war is also not about NATO incursions on Russian security. Ukraine voluntarily gave up its nuclear weapons in the very misplaced hope that somebody might be pacified and that Western security guarantees will be delivered. In 1991, I was translating for a firebrand MP from Ukraine, Andriy Cheremsky. He was about 26 years old, came to Australia. We drove down to Canberra. We had a meeting with Tim Fischer. And Fischer asked this young, new nationalist MP of this brand new independent country that suddenly has a nuclear stockpile, what are you going to do with the missiles? And Cheremsky, in Ukrainian, said to Fischer, we are going to point them at Moscow. And me being sort of in politics at the time and having a tendency towards diplomacy, said something of the order, we will use them to our strategic advantage, we will place them in positions that, that suit our future interests, blah, de, blah, de, blah, de, blah. To that point, I didn't know that Cheremsky spoke English. And he turned to Tim Fischer and he says, no, I didn't say that. We will point them at Moscow. And, I was horrified. And now looking back at events, the young firebrand politician was right, and this sophisticate was wrong. And this war isn't about defending ethnic Russians or about some form of separatism. One of the things that should be noted is that many, if not most, of Ukraine's frontline soldiers in 2014, when this all began, are actually Russian speakers or ethnic Russians. And there were indeed no internecine inklings prior to Putin's incursions in 14. These are all just lies. They're lies to justify an unprovoked invasion. I was volunteering in the Ukrainian government, working for the Minister for Health in 2018, when a British colleague coined a term, and he says, Putin's Russia lies on an industrial scale. And he's quite poignant. The truth of what we've seen since the occupation of Crimea and parts of Donetsk and Luhansk in 14 and the ramping up of the war since February is a continuation of a historical arc. It's a sequel of sequels, albeit with deadlier weapons, digitized disinformation, and arguably fewer moral constraints on the part of the invading fascistic force. What Putin hopes to achieve, with sadly strong support by mainstream Russians, if polling's to be believed, which is about 80% at the moment in favor of the war, is what his Tsarist, Bolshevik, and Soviet predecessors failed to achieve. The full subjugation of the Ukrainian nation within the political and cultural fold of some greater Russia. In a limited moment of candor, Putin has recently now spoken of himself as continuing Tsar Peter's important imperial mission. That's the truth of the matter. And perhaps he's continuing someone else's mission too. In the 1930s, Stalin attempted to starve Ukrainians out of existence, and he killed some 5 million people, arguably during his forced famine. When I was in Ukraine this last time, I was on a farm owned by a very wealthy man who had literally bought it from being a collective farm and now operates it privately. And during the war period, prices were so bad that he's had to take some of his workers and have them do other things on the farm because the agricultural side is looking so poor. So he decided to renovate the church in the village of the farm. And as they were renovating it, they found shallow graves along the church fence. And in those shallow graves were, in fact, bones that they discovered of people who had perished in the famine. So these things are still very real in Ukraine. Nearly 100 years later, there are strong similarities in the sinister ethnocidal strategies of Putin and his sycophants, right down to the recent theft of some 20 million tons of Ukrainian grain. And if you don't think that's important, about 40% of the grain that goes to Africa every year is either from Ukraine or Russia. It's massive. Given such aspects, some in the West, be it the Chancellor of Germany, who sells arms to Putin and buys energy from Putin, or even some in the Australian Commentariat, and unfortunately they're mostly from the center-right of things, should be ashamed of themselves. Under the guise of realpolitik, they amplify the Kremlin's pseudo-arguments and advocate appeasement, whether that's providing some kind of off-ramp to Putin, or curtailing military support, or permanently ceding Ukrainian territory. You give it away. Give away the Donetsk and Luhansk, and give away Kherson, and the millions of people who live there to authoritarian occupation. These folks are the political progeny of Henry Kissinger, and they don't have qualms about handing over Ukrainian freedoms and lives to satisfy Putin, without any consultation with Ukrainians, of course. These elites think accommodation will lead to some kind of non-interference in our societies, in international norms like territorial sovereignty, or in global energy and food supply chains. It's not surprising that privileged policy sophisticates are amoral. What is bizarre, though, is that they calculate their concoctions for compromise will convince a dictator who romps all over every sign of retreat. I sometimes wonder, is it harder to pardon downright strategic and policy stupidity than it is to pardon moral turbidity? I introduced Pavlo Kovtanyuk, who runs a healthcare think tank in Kyiv and was assistant health minister of Ukraine from 16 to 19. Kovtanyuk's job, and I worked with him, then included funding construction of brand new health facilities. His mission now is to chronicle their destruction. And he's doing this for the purposes of war crimes prosecutions under the Geneva Convention. So with Kovtanyuk and on my own, I visited any number of different healthcare facilities that have been shelled out of existence across Ukraine over the last 3 months. Kovtanyuk has collected evidence about approximately 170 healthcare facilities, and that doesn't include pharmacies, and that doesn't include ambulance stations. That's just hospitals and clinics, including he's identified a proportion of those that have been intentionally destroyed, e.g. they haven't just been wiped out in mass bombing. They've been picked out as a target and then bombed intentionally. One's a former new family medical center outside of Kyiv where we documented how mortar rounds were actually stepped into the targets. There were craters of every 10 meters, and you can see how a mortar crew of three or four young boys
with a spotter, made sure that they were hitting the health clinic. So think about all the micro decisions that go into that and ask yourself a question, is Putin only to blame for this war? All that remains at that site is a banner urging COVID vaccination. Another was the childcare center for workers' kids on the grounds of a general hospital in Mykolaiv. Nothing else there, no housing, no military targets, nothing. One shell directed at the childcare center on the hospital grounds. We learned via Kovtinyuk's work and other sources that the main method of how this war is being conducted is what I call desertification, to make a desert out of something. The invaders' idea, implemented through the most intense artillery barrages since World War II, is to nullify all necessities for normality. If you have no heating, healthcare, schools, shopping, water, electricity, pharmacies, and the like, life cannot be sustained. According to Kovtinyuk, this is Russia's pattern of behavior. So he's now working with other NGOs to establish an evidence that Russia's practice of what you might call pulverization was actually used identically in Syria and in Georgia. What is forced in turn is internal and external displacement of what Kovtinyuk calls genocide by migration. Some 10 million people out of a population of 40 million are now not in their own homes, either overseas or displaced elsewhere in Ukraine. So for some scale, think about all of Sydney having to move to Melbourne and Brisbane and New Zealand over the course of 5 months. A quarter of the country basically displaced. If one chooses to stay, one risks systematic intimidation, unchecked robbery, mass rape, as we saw from Russian gangster units in the case of Bucha and Irpin, which I visited and are remarkable not only for their suffering, but their recovery. I saw one woman who was painting sunflowers around the bullet holes on her fence. It's extraordinary that many people still choose to stay in their homes, in their communities, in their jobs as truck drivers or online teachers, in their country and in the fight. I've written how Ukraine's centuries-long experience of violence and colonization has distilled a very pure type of strength and courage in many of its citizens, the kind we really haven't seen in the West since the Greatest Generation. As in their case, trauma isn't only traumatic, it can be transformative. PTS can be a positive as much as it is a negative in people's lives. Values needn't be only inherited or incidental, they are empowering when they are actively adopted and anointed in sacrifice. Ukrainian bravery is being put to a new test as the war is shifting shape. After their defeat at Kyiv and Kharkiv, and having been reduced from 125 battalion groups to 75 such units, Russian commanders have done what's only logical and perhaps what's only available now: concentrate their fire. So to give you the numbers, a battalion tactical group has about 1,000 people in it. On official statistics, the Russians have lost about 30 to 35,000 soldiers all up. So when you do the numbers between 125 times 1,000, 75 times 1,000, you can see that those loss rates actually make a lot of sense. By the way, on Bucha and Irpin, that was occupied by the 65th Mechanized Infantry Battalion of the Russian Army, now granted a guardian status by Putin. It's a special recognition in the Russian military. One of the moments of justice in the world so far in this war is they were transferred from Kyiv after the Battle of Kyiv had been won by the Ukrainians to the east, and they were wiped out to a man. About 630 of them. So they're concentrating their fire in Donbas, and what we have now is a three-tiered war. The first tier is a war on the eastern front of attrition by artillery. Up to 50,000 Russian shells are falling every day. And so by way of comparison, the United States Army, which I served in, orders 150,000 shells per year in terms of resupply. Such broadacre artillery action is because Russia is unwilling to substantially go forward due to its dysfunctional and demoralized mechanized infantry and its sanction-impacted dwindling supplies. At the same time, Ukraine is unable to go forward due to a lack of sufficient artillery and air cover. So we're stuck in the east, effectively lobbing artillery shells at each other, with theirs being a lot more numerous than the Ukrainians. The second tier of warfare is the continued random ruination of Ukrainian towns and cities using long-range missiles. Yesterday, 30 civilians were killed at Chasiv Yar when their apartment building was rocketed, and it was one of 10 attacks in one day. Random in aim, but for one, and that is to kill and terrorize locals. I visited Saltivka, which is outside of Kharkiv, and I saw a 10-story apartment building that had been leveled. And I asked, how did this all come down? And you could see there was a kind of shaft in the building. And the military guys I was with explained to me that it was a caliber missile. And I was like, oh, yeah, what's a caliber missile? Caliber missiles are fired from about 1,500 kilometers away from the Black Sea from a ship. They cost about $6 million each to destroy a 10-story apartment building. Later that day, colleagues and I witnessed an artillery assault by retreating Russian forces. They were about 30 kilometers away on a suburban high street in Kharkiv. In the preceding days, residents had started coming out for coffee to the pharmacy to buy spring flowers, which Ukrainians absolutely adore. And unfortunately, several locals were cut to pieces by shrapnel and died on the pavement just trying to be normal. Thankfully, my colleagues managed to save a couple of people too. The third tier of warfare is what I call plethoric propaganda. That means pressuring Ukraine's allies through economic and energy threats to succumb to Russian ambitions. More from desperation than by design, the world's biggest mafia boss is now weaponizing food and fuel. So next time you're filling up for $2.50, blame Putin. It's a mobster's standover tactic. Meanwhile, the Kremlin spin servants recently made a big deal of gaining further territory in the east. The two cities in question are the significance and size of Bendigo and Ballarat. It took the Russians 2 months, 10,000 of their own soldiers' lives, and more than 500,000 shells to take these two towns, a grand victory. It's disheartening to read mainstream journalists fall for falsehoods, and here I channel Gerard Henderson. Some write this up as if it's the 21st century Stalingrad. They remain transfixed by the carefully curated illusion of Russian invincibility. They suggest that Russian victory, while messy, is somehow inevitable. Perhaps they are ignorant of the fact that bar World War II and the Allies' support of Russia, every major Russian military involvement since the 19th century has been a defeat. They're one of the worst performing militaries in 19th and 20th century history. Starting from 1904 in the Russo-Japanese War, where the commanding admiral ordered that a mine be removed as he was leaving port, his orders were not followed, and he sailed onto the mine on his way back, thereby killing himself. It's journalistic dilettantism. It lazily ignores that the front is thousands of kilometers long, the Ukrainian forces have been taking back villages in the southern part of the country at the same time, and the chronic incompetence and corruption of the Russian military. It's as if major Russian losses in the spring at Kyiv and Kharkiv, as well as the stalemate over 8 years in Donbass, were somehow flukes. They weren't. NATO senior commanders come to Ukraine and learn how to fight Putin from Ukrainians. They don't teach Ukrainians how to fight. Attention blindness about Ukraine, the phenomenon where one looks but does not see, is a bad habit from journalistic institutions like CNN and the New York Times. So here's a small one. On the first day of the war, a CNN journalist was outside the gates of Hostomel Airport, which the Russians were trying to land paratroopers in, which is another story. I'm an ex-paratrooper. You never send paratroopers into those kinds of situations. And the CNN journalist is running around very excitedly saying, for some reason, we have found ourselves here as the Russian paratroopers are taking the airport for some reason. As if a Western journalist, any journalist, can just rock up to a war zone and suddenly be in the midst of the action. So the media manipulation is significant. Media perceptions aside, it's nevertheless estimated that Russia outguns Ukraine by at least 4-1 in terms of heavy artillery. Until recently, Russia's capability at long ranges was uncontested. A Ukrainian officer in an intelligence bunker showed me a video screen, and he showed me all the targets in pink that he says, I can't hit those. He says, those are the targets, quote unquote, waiting for Mr. Howitzer to say hello. Without that firepower, to that point, all they could do was hit those targets with special ops missions or homemade kamikaze drones. And I saw in live time what $500 from Dick Smith in drones can actually do to a $500,000 Russian APC. It's extraordinary. They literally build their own weaponry using 3D printing and explosives and commercial drones.
Maybe you finished pretty quickly.
Yep. The equation's changing. Last month has seen a promised heavy weaponry arriving and being deployed, and there's a change in momentum. Last week, we saw troops, Russian troops, trying to go outside illicit chance. They lost 10 tanks. Over the last 2 weeks, we've seen some half a dozen Russian weapons depots and two major command posts being destroyed in the south. I visited there last month, and it's likely that you'll see a counterattack there in the not-too-distant future. And finishing up, the mood has changed in Ukraine in the 3 months that I've been there. It was first about, we must defend ourselves. And then the atrocities in Bucha and Irpin and elsewhere happened, and it shifted radically and it shifted fast. It became one of, not just we must defend ourselves, we must avenge these losses, and we must defeat Putin. It's a very different notion, and it's a notion that, in fact, the West needs to consider. What are the West's strategic goals in supporting Ukraine? Is it to let these people fight a fair fight, or is it to preserve a particular global order, or is it regime change in Russia? It's an important question and one that I don't have the answer to. But maybe Dima Sherembay, who's the leader of the 207th Battalion of the Territorial Defense, does. His unit took part in the Battle of Kyiv, and one of their special operations was to take Elon Musk's Starlinks and put them out all over the country so that Ukrainian soldiers could still communicate by internet. He says this, and Dima, by the way, is a Russian speaker, and he runs the largest HIV-related social service provider in the country in his spare time from the front lines. So this is Dima's quote to me. We didn't just beat the orcs at Kyiv, we defeated the myth of Russian power. We've shown the world that modern Russia is in fact an open sewer and that Putin is a political pedophile who preys on those he thinks are weaker. Therefore, there needs to be total operational, economic, and emotional defeat of Russia. Otherwise, it cannot recognize its own paralysis, cannot pay its own penance, and cannot change for the better. Not such a radical notion if you think about Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Ladies and gentlemen, Katerina, Pavlo, Dima, and their countrymen are for mine proxies of principle for our way of life, our beliefs, and our democracy. And I, for one, feel indebted to have spent some time with them as they fight towards their country's victory. Thank you.
Peter. We come back, we come up. So we go to questions and discussion. Now, there are a lot of people here and a lot of people on the Zoom call, and we've got to be brief. So
yes.
You come across here, Peter. I'll just start with you, Peter, and you may want to, but brief comments. As you mentioned, Zelensky is regarded as Churchill in a T-shirt, but is there a cult of personality in Ukraine? Start with you, Peter. You just come back. Brief comment and brief comment. Come back here, will you, and talk to them.
So in the 3 months or so that I traveled around the country, I didn't see one portrait of Zelensky in any public institution or in any private setting. He is a man that's highly regarded. He's respected. Everybody says that had he abandoned his office in the first couple of days, the war would be over. But Ukrainians are the ultimate Democrats. They've changed presidents at every election, and they change them fairly. Their attitude is, you're there to do a job. For as long as you do it, we respect you. Once you stop doing it, we get rid of you. He finished fifth in a contest where they were voting for the next big stamp in Ukraine. And the thing that finished first was a Jack Russell who sniffs for bombs.
Okay, so there's a question down there that will come across here. Yep, Jared.
Just following on from that last comment, to what extent does Zelensky agree with you that total victory is necessary, because we hear comments from time to time that he's prepared to negotiate, he's prepared to perhaps look for a Kissinger-type settlement. To what extent do you think he's determined to push all the way?
So I'll refer back to my first answer, and that is that Ukraine is an extraordinarily democratic place. And if any leader, be it Zelensky or the leader of the parliament or anyone else in high office, were to suggest some strategy of compromise or of giving away territory at the moment, given the atrocities, given the human rights violations, they would throw them out within 24 hours. Zelensky has no choice but to prosecute this war to its very, very end. And in Ukrainians' minds, that is a full return of all territories and the like. And I know that's hard to believe, but that's what's going to happen.
Andrew, compromise or no compromise?
No, I agree, no compromise. I think Zelensky's made it actually quite clear. I think the rumors are coming out not from Ukraine, I think, but from White House and Downing Street, who would like to see that, but they won't.
There's a question here.
So my question would be, if Ukraine is able to receive from the West the weapons that it needs, do you envisage, how do you envisage the conflict playing out?
What we know is that the weapons that have been granted today, and let me put that into context, Ukraine basically said that it needs 1,000 howitzers to come to artillery parity. At the moment, they have about 120. So they're still looking for about 800 plus howitzers just to be able to say we're at the same level. With the equipment that they have received to date, and I saw it in action, they are very adept at integrating it into their existing military doctrines. They're fast learners, and we can never forget this. It's a cliche, but cliches are often true. An army that has a reason to fight always fights much more effectively than an army that doesn't. Awful stories from the Russian side. For example, recruiting, if you did a map and you looked at which territories have provided the most soldiers to the Russian cause, which provinces, Moscow has a rate of about 3 in every 100 young men right now. St. Petersburg, about 2 in every 100 young men. You go out to some of the quote-unquote ethnic or Asian provinces, it's looking like 60 out of 100 young men. This is a war that has tremendous racist overtones in its own right. Point is, the more weapons they get, the more effective they will be against an enemy that basically is completely demoralized.
You want to answer that? No, so, okay.
There's been reports, can anyone hear me? There's been reports in the Australian yesterday, about a sort of preparation for a more assertive rather than defensive Ukrainian campaign. To what extent is this true? And to what extent is it dependent on the Americans and the Germans and the British actually delivering the weapons they promised?
Ex-Army, you can only go forward if you have artillery cover or air cover. Up until now, the Ukrainians have lacked both. Now, some of this heavy stuff is starting to flow. A HIMARS system can hit targets of 80 to 150 kilometers away. What that does is clear the path for your mechanized infantry to go forward. And so as that heavy weaponry starts to arrive, we're already starting to see signs, for example, in the south, where I spent a fair bit of time, of the Ukrainians advancing on Kherson, and Kherson's a stepping stone to Crimea. So when you look at things like that, and you look at the fact that, for example, the army has gone from 300,000 to 700,000 with a plan to go to 1 million in the next 6 months, and this whole period of artillery exchange is a fantastic one for training your troops, it's very likely that come the cooler weather after summer, you will see counter-offensives. There's also a time clock on this, and that is Ukrainians fear living without heat for a winter,
And that is a very big likelihood if Mr. Putin wants to continue that notion of desertification of their lands.
Do you
want to
comment on that?
So where are the... well, firstly, does the about-to-be ending prime ministership of Boris Johnson, is that going to make any difference? And predominantly at the moment, where are the weapons coming from in the West, from the Western nations?
The one thing that every contender for the British prime ministership agrees on is assistance to Ukraine. So whether it's Liz Truss or any other, they're almost out competing each other on who can be more supportive. I was in England in between the journalism work, and I laughed to Susie, my partner, that Russia may have invaded Ukraine, but Ukraine has successfully invaded England based on all the Ukrainian flags that are literally on every house. So Britain has been steadfast. It's almost a justification of Brexit, I might add, given how awful the Germans in particular have been and two-faced. The weaponry is mostly from the United States. It's the largest allocation they've made. It's about a third of what they spent during their whole time in Afghanistan. Australia should be really proud of itself, $390 million so far. 40 Bushmaster vehicles, which are the best in the world. Six howitzers, which is a full battery. And any number of other forms of assistance. We are punching way above our weight. We're clear about what we're doing, and we're doing it from both sides of the house. We're awesome, and we are so, so respected in Ukraine that it's extraordinary. It's more than just the cute koala factor. They kind of get that we're a little place defending ourselves against a big place, and look at this, you guys are willing to sacrifice for us. You're a little place too.
Perhaps we could have had a koala rather than a Jack Russell on the stand.
Can I just ask a quick question following on from that? What was your take on how Ukrainians view other countries? Like, I'm thinking particularly of France, Mr. Macron, who's on the phone to Putin every day, for example. Do they know all that? Is that getting through?
They're highly plugged in. They use Telegram in particular as this constant live feed of information and news and media, and even frontline soldiers will literally tell you. I remember one day we were inspecting a site that had been shelled with artillery, and the young artillery officer was taking his measurements and showing me how to calculate where the shells had come from and writing it all down in his iPad. And whilst he's writing it down in his iPad, he's also checking Telegram for what Macron said last, literally on the front. Look, it's extremely maddening for Ukrainians. So they couch their fight in terms of democracy, the freedoms that we basically associate with the West and you associate with the European tradition. And then they look at the actual behavior, particularly from France and from Germany and from Italy, who had three prime ministers who turned up in Kiev. Big hoo-ha, had CNN take photographs of themselves on the train on the way in, heroics, the sort of the ritualistic visit to the sites where the atrocities have taken place. And their grand announcement over the course of that day was, we'll give you an application form to join the European Union. So Ukrainians look at this and say, we're fighting for the things that you purportedly stand for, and you're happy to give us diplomatic frameworks and gestures. They look to Britain, they look to the United States, they look to us, they effectively look to non-European partners more than they look to European partners.
Yeah, it's a question here.
Could you comment on energy, the fuel requirements of Ukraine, and how they're being satisfied?
Well, question about energy and fuel requirements in Ukraine.
Great question. Yeah. Energy is the unspoken aspect of this entire war in some respects. So when we talk about France and Germany and Italy and the like, and we ask ourselves about motive, it's very much about energy, and not just access to energy, but access to cheap energy, which puts in mind a kind of awful trade-off between cheap energy and Ukrainian lives in some respects. Ukrainians themselves have access to nuclear, they have access to coal reserves, they don't have sufficient access to gas, which has historically been imported from Russia.
The deals that have been done lately are effectively reverse pipelines from Poland, Moldova, Romania, so that gas will come into the country from the southern direction come winter to a greater degree than it has in the past. They're preparing for an awful winter. They know that the winter, if the war is still going on by winter, that will be kind of the make or break point psychologically, largely because of access to energy.
And Australia's sending of coal, was that noticed in Ukraine?
Yeah, they are. There's an export agreement now for coal. People do not know or remember this, but after the MH17 situation, when relationships between Australia and Ukraine grew to a larger extent than ever, and again, this is one of the reasons that Ukrainians have huge respect for Australians, is the way they bore themselves through that entire awful situation. And Angus Houston is revered, for example, in Ukraine for the role that he played there. They signed during that period an agreement between Tony Abbott and then President Poroshenko for the importation of Australian uranium to Ukraine. That may still play itself out in the next year.
Well, tell us about Zelensky. The key question that people usually ask about comedians is, was he funny?
Well, you know, there is a difference in the sense of humor in Eastern Europe and Australia. But certainly for his audience, he was very funny. He was very successful. I mean, he's very rich and successful. And his production company did more than one show. And his wife was also a writer for the show. And am I right in thinking that he actually, in Ukraine, he was at one stage, he was sort of like the number one comic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so he must have been funny, even if some of the stuff that I've seen is not hugely funny for Australian sense of humor.
Oh, you mean like playing the piano?
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
but Mr. Putin doesn't think he's funny.
No, I don't know if you saw footage. There was when the only time that I think the only time they were together was at the table when Zelensky was meeting Putin and a few others sitting around the table. You could see the body language was funny. That was funny.
So I've actually written an article. I got a little bit frustrated because I kept on reading all these characterizations of Putin, that he's a madman or that he's a master strategist or that he's paranoid or he's this or that other, the sort of kind of like armchair psychological evaluation of Putin. So what I decided to do was actually do it properly, and with psychology friends, we got up the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and we went through various diagnoses with psychology friends, and we actually have a working thesis that he has what's called antisocial personality disorder. And it is a real condition, and it is very prevalent. For example, where the database comes from in this, the evidence comes from this, are American mafioso bosses in prison. And amongst the characteristics are, for example, a ruthlessness about ambitions and achievements, coupled with an extreme loyalty to those you're closest to. If you think about the stereotypes of mafia characters, the Sopranos of the world, that's exactly it. And if you go through the other characteristics, he aligns very closely. And I think where Zelensky's great strength is the man's a performer. He's an artist. He's empathetic. He's emotional. He understands audience. So I actually think that he's cracked Putin better than any other world leader has. And he knows that to mock him actually gives him greater advantage than anything else because of that antisocial personality disorder.
The final question, we'll start off with Peter. Very brief, 30-second answers. If you're back here in a year's time, what do you think the outcome might be? And then to you, Andrew. Difficult question, but important.
The war will still be on, but it will continue to change shape as it has for the last 5 months. I described the three tiers that we're in right now. It's likely that those three tiers will shift to a fourth, and that's counterattack, particularly through the south. The more that occurs, I would venture to say, the more untenable Vladimir Putin becomes as the ruler of Russia. And we would hope and pray, and here I'll be very radical, and I'm happy to do it on the camera, that somebody effects what I call the one bullet solution.
Andrew?
Yeah, look, I agree with Pete, but I would add one proviso, which of course is the one that all politicians fear: events. And I think what happens in the next little while will depend on events like what will the West, particularly US, Britain and Germany, do. Because they've been very slow and not very committed to fully arming Ukraine. If that changes even more than it has, then I think there'll be a different scenario.
Okay, many thanks. We've had a stimulating discussion tonight. We're right on time. So thanks to Peter Smeagol and to Andrew Urban. And of course, we've got copies of Andrew's book, Zelensky, the Unlikely Ukrainian Hero. So for tonight, we'd love to have you back in a year's time. And we hope the news will be good then. But for tonight, thank you. And thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Jared. Thank you.